From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the investigation intensifies into the deliberate crash of a German airliner into the French Alps as the home of the co-pilot is searched.
We will search the entire apartment, and naturally, we're hoping that this will give some indication of, let's say, the circumstances that might eventually have led to the plane crash.
The Saudi Arabian effort led to effort to oust the Shiite Houthi group from positions of power in Yemen continues, and the Syrian president says he's open to a dialogue with the United States. That is all ahead. I'm Ira Melman. German police have searched the homes of the German co-pilot who was believed to have crashed an Airbus jetliner into the French Alps on purpose, killing himself and 149 others. On Friday, police searched two homes where 27-year-old Andreas Lubitz stayed, one not flying, an apartment he kept in the German city of Düsseldorf, and his parents' home in the small German town of Montabaur. Police said several items were taken as evidence. German prosecutors are now saying no evidence of political, religious background has been found to the crash. Zlatica Hoek has more on the story.
German authorities on Thursday searched the apartment near Frankfurt that was used by Andreas Lubitz, the 27-year-old German co-pilot of the Airbus 320 that crashed Tuesday in the French Alps.
The French authorities have not given us any specific information regarding what we should be looking for here, but of course we will search the entire apartment, and naturally we're hoping that this will give some indication of, let's say, the circumstances that might eventually have led to the plane crash, or perhaps a motivation.
Flight recordings indicate that Lubitz most likely locked the pilot out of the cockpit before deliberately ramming the aircraft into a mountain. The investigation so far has revealed that Lubitz had a period of depression, which forced him to take a six-month break from flight training. Before resuming the training, he passed physical and psychological tests. Experts say that crash makes it clear the procedures are inadequate.
The aptitude tests will have to be revised. The psychological part will have to be extended massively. But most of all, the pilots will have to be psychologically cared for outside their occupation in a way that has not been the case so far. For one, to check their psychological condition at the annual medical checkups, whether they have any life crises, worries, or are they under pressure from the outside. And the pilots will have to be trained to check on their colleagues and ask them how they are doing, whether they are doing badly, or whether they feel excluded, mobbed, whether they feel depressed.
German aviation expert Harald Stocker says a deliberate plane crash will affect the commercial airline industry as profoundly as the September 11 terrorist attacks did in 2001.
So far, we assumed that pilots do not have any suicidal intentions, that they fly responsibly. And now we have learned that pilots can kill 150 people on board by having suicidal intentions.
Safety procedures established after 2001 enable pilots to lock themselves in the cockpit to prevent terrorists from hijacking the plane. Stocker says that rule is likely to stay in place, but other regulations may be added to ensure safety.
In America, for instance, there is a rule that a pilot must never be alone in the cockpit. And if there are only two pilots, a cabin attendant must step in if one of the two leaves the cockpit, so that at least two people are present who can look after each other.
People in Germany, France, and Spain on Thursday honored the victims of the crash. Some traveled to the crash location in the French Alps. Psychologists say knowledge that someone deliberately caused the deaths of their loved ones will make the loss harder to bear. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Helicopters continue to shuttle back and forth from the German Wings crash site as investigators continue retrieving remains and pieces of the plane shattered into small particles from the high-speed impact of the crash. To commemorate the 150 victims who were killed in Tuesday's crash, a makeshift memorial has been erected in the French Alpine village of Le Vernet, which is the closest inhabited place to the disaster site. Relatives of the victims, as well as locals, have laid out flowers and candles beside a memorial stone. Fighter jets are striking rebel targets in Yemen for a second consecutive day as part of a Saudi Arabia-led regional effort to oust the Shiite Houthi group that has taken over much of that country. Friday's targets included the northern stronghold of Yemen's Shiite rebels and other key military installations. This military action is turning impoverished and chaotic Yemen into a new front in the rivalry between Sunni heavyweight Saudi Arabia and Shiite power Iran, which supports the rebels known as the Houthis. Heavy airstrikes early Friday targeted Sa'adah, the stronghold of the Houthis, focusing on locations where rebel leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi might be. According to military officials, Saudi warplanes also bombed the al-Sana army camp in the Arab region northeast of Sana'a, run by commanders loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Now, Yemen's internal conflict has expanded regionally with airstrikes from a Saudi Arabia-led coalition and a vow by Egypt to commit ground troops if they are needed. Yemen's displaced president, Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, and the Houthi militia have only gotten farther from the negotiating table than 6 months ago when the northern rebels pushed the government out of the capital. Experts are saying the international community has failed Yemen by focusing too much on the fight against al-Qaeda and not enough on the country's own development. Victoria Mackey has more from Washington.
Bloodshed in Sana'a. Residents of Yemen's capital pulled the dead from rubble after daybreak Thursday in the aftermath of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia against the Houthi militia. At least 25 people were killed, including children. In the southern city of Taiz, supporters of President Hadi lauded the bombings. Backers of the rebel group, which overran the Yemeni capital in recent months in a bid for increased political power, decried the air attack.
This criminal and unjust intervention is brutal and offensive. It is completely unjustified.
The United Nations has failed to mediate a peace deal between the internationally recognized President Hadi and the Houthis, who have been linked to Iran. Hadi fled to Riyadh after the rebels encroached on his refuge in the southern city of Aden this week.
Given the Houthis' failure to engage meaningfully in the
Washington said it backed the anti-Houthi air attack with logistic and intelligence support. Yemen experts in Washington urged caution in conflating a local conflict with a regional one and downplayed Iran's role in supporting the Houthi militia.
I think we need to understand this power struggle, this power play, this power vacuum, what is going on in Yemen in very Yemeni domestic terms, and not overread it as a regional proxy war.
Despite massive external aid to Yemen, former CIA official William D. Murray said international counter-terror efforts against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula drew funds and focus away from the root causes of Yemen's instability: weak economic and development infrastructure.
This is not a failed state. This is not another Somalia. This is not a place that's in the process of dissolving. It's a country that has a long-term problem that's never been resolved. There is a sense that there is a Yemen, and that's not gone away yet.
Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Washington.
More on the Yemeni situation now. The main political parties and the Houthi opposition have failed to reach agreement on how to end Yemen's political deadlock despite negotiations. The rebels had given the country's political factions until Wednesday to fill the vacuum left by the resignation of the president, Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. The Houthis took control of the capital last September, and they've demanded greater involvement in the country's army and the police force. They forced President Hadi's resignation last month. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with several regional experts about where Yemen is heading.
Marina Otaway, what was termed as Arab Spring, turned into some sort of cold winter. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think transformations of a society are always extremely difficult. And I think it was naive on the part of everybody to think that uprisings of this sort would have a lasting effect. The important thing is what happened next. And in the case of Tunisia, for example, where you had organized political parties, organized political forces on both sides, both in terms of change and maintaining the status quo, that intervene in the process, you ended up by having not a revolution, but certainly a transition towards a normal political process of participation and so on. In a country like Egypt, where the political forces were very disorganized. The youth movements, for example, never went beyond the capacity to mobilize people to come out on the street. You cannot run a country through mobilizing people to come out in the street. So that essentially, what was missing in Egypt was an organized political force that could intervene other than the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood frightened the military into taking over again.
So where do you see Egypt headed 4 years after its uprising of 2011?
I think for the foreseeable future, we are going to stay with this very repressive political system. Whether or not they can get the economy in order to some extent, I don't know. But certainly there is not going to be any movement politically right now. Is there going to be another push from the bottom, another uprising of sorts at some point? It's possible, but I don't see it happening immediately. I think right now it's repression.
How could both Egypt and Yemen get over the challenge of going backward toward autocracy?
Well, I think Yemen is very different from Egypt because Egypt, the state is still intact. There is still, it's a very authoritarian state, but the state is still intact. The administration is still intact and so on. So that in a sense, it is conceivable to think that it will open up, that there will be, for example, if the government decided to leave more space for the political party to run into the elections and so on, it could change towards a more open, not democratic, but at least somewhat more open political system. I think in Yemen at this point, I mean, Yemen was always a very tribal country, but it has almost disintegrated into militias and tribal groups and so on, so that you cannot even start talking about a new political system at this point. The big challenge is whether that state can be put together one way or another.
Final question. What could the U.S. do to impact a real transition to democracy, especially in Egypt?
I think the United States, unfortunately, has very little leverage on al-Sisi. He does not owe his power to any support he gets from the United States. And he knows very well that the United States does not want to lose that relations with Egypt because of its interest in not only Israel, frankly, but more broadly in the entire region. Egypt is, after all, a stable country, and it's a country that has a military, for example, which could become crucial in restabilizing Libya, for example.
VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi on the future of Yemen. Thanks for being with us. This is International Edition from the Voice of America. Syrian President Bashar Assad says he would be open to a dialogue with the United States, but that it must be based on mutual respect. Assad made the remarks in an interview with Charlie Rose for CBS News 60 Minutes. A short excerpt of the interview was posted online late Thursday. In the clip, Assad said that, in principle, every dialogue is a positive thing, and we're going to be open to any dialogue with anyone, including the United States. He said there is no direct communication so far with Washington. Assad's comments came after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said earlier this month that the U.S. must eventually talk with the Syrian government to help broker an end to that country's civil war. The Obama administration later reiterated its position that Assad has no future role in Syria. Meanwhile, the United Nations says the humanitarian crisis in Syria has become increasingly grim. The UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, told the UN Security Council that the number of Syrians who risk death by starvation, dehydration, and the lack of medical care has nearly doubled from earlier estimates to roughly 440,000.
At a time when needs are growing and the humanitarian community should be scaling up its response, the government continues to put in place measures that are not practical and slow down our response. So far this year, the United Nations has requested access to 33 locations for the delivery of aid through interagency convoys. Only three have been agreed.
In her appeal to the UN Security Council, Amos also issued a challenge to members to bring about a positive humanitarian outcome.
The inability of this council and countries with influence over the different parties at war in Syria to agree on the elements for a political solution in the country means that the humanitarian consequences will continue to be dire for millions of Syrians.
The UN and its partners are providing aid to millions of people each month, including through cross-border operations, but the agency has struggled to collect the funds promised to cope with the humanitarian crisis. U.S. and Iranian negotiators are set Friday to continue a final round of talks on Tehran's nuclear program as a March 31st deadline to reach a framework deal draws closer. U.S. Secretary of State Kerry met Thursday with Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif in Lausanne, Switzerland. Both sides have expressed optimism a deal can be reached. Senior diplomats of the other so-called P5+1 nations participating in the talks are expected to soon join their Iranian U.S. counterparts as diplomacy heats up ahead of the deadline. Thursday, the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said he sent a letter to the six world powers explaining Iran's position on nuclear issues and latest developments in the negotiations. U.S. officials confirmed receiving the letter, but they didn't disclose its contents. Speaking via Twitter, Mr. Rouhani also said he spoke with the leaders of China, Russia, France, and Britain, emphasizing that just all unjust sanctions against Iran must be dropped. Iran wants international sanctions against it immediately dropped as part of a nuclear deal, while the U.S. and others say the sanctions should be lifted gradually. There is also some disagreement over other issues, and they include the amount and quality of enriched uranium that Iran would be able to develop. Iran and the P5+1 partners, the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany, have said it's crucial to reach a framework deal before March 31st, but the hard deadline for a deal is the end of June. China is forging ahead with reclamation projects on at least seven tiny but hotly contested features in the South China Sea, posing what could be a major challenge in the Philippines' international arbitration case against China. From Manila, Simone Arundine reports surveys of the disputed outcroppings will be key.
Since the beginning of the year, various satellite images of Chinese reclamation work in the Spratly Islands have shown shoals and reefs turning into artificial islands. Major harbors that can dock military ships are nearly completed. So are several airstrips and at least three multi-story buildings where bear outposts once stood. Philippine Foreign Affairs Secretary Albert Del Rosario said at a forum in Manila Thursday, his government has protested what he calls the massive reclamation activities of China.
The alteration of these features are plainly intended to change the character, status, and maritime entitlements of the said features, which prejudice the arbitration and undermine the work of the arbitral tribunal to hear and objectively decide the case.
In January 2013, the Philippines filed a case with the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, seeking affirmation on features it is contesting with China based on definitions of international law. Just about every single feature included in the filing now has Chinese reclamation work in progress. The case also questions what Manila calls Beijing's excessive claims in the South China Sea. China opted out of arbitration in certain cases when it signed on to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and it rejects the filing. China says it has indisputable sovereignty over practically the entire sea. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam also have claims in the resource-rich sea. The Philippines argues that certain features China took over are low-tide elevations, meaning at high tide they are completely submerged. It says they are far from China's territorial sea, which makes them either part of another state's continental shelf or part of the international seabed. The Philippines also deems four reefs rocks, saying even if they are above sea level at high tide, they are uninhabitable and incapable of supporting economic life in their natural state. When features are disputed, international law does not recognize their altered states. But there has to be proof of what they were before they were changed. Gregory Poling specializes in the disputes in the South China Sea at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says such cases are rare, and in the only other case he could recall, the international court's standards were tough.
They
Simone Orendine reporting from Manila. South Korea Friday demanded the immediate release of two nationals arrested in North Korea on espionage charges. North Korea announced late Thursday that it had arrested two South Korean men last year in the Chinese border city of Dandong. State media said the two were working to smear North Korea. The official Korean Central News Agency said the two took part in an anti-DPRK smear campaign organized by U.S. intelligence and the South Korean National Intelligence Service. South Korea described the allegations as groundless and demanded that the two men be immediately released and repatriated. The Nigerian military says soldiers have retaken the town of Gwoza, one of the last areas in northeastern Nigeria controlled by the militant group Boko Haram. Military says on Twitter that troops captured the Borno state town Friday morning and destroyed the headquarters of Boko Haram's self-declared caliphate. It said more details would follow. This unconfirmed report came out 24 hours before Nigerians go to the polls for presidential and parliamentary elections. President Goodluck Jonathan and the ruling PDP party are facing a tough challenge from the opposition APC and its presidential candidate. Thank you so much for joining us today for International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on voanews.com. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abubakar Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abubakar Sikwa and Imam Abubakar Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.